Hey, Mickey.
Hey, Rob. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Fine. You're on strike, I hear.
Yes. Well, yeah. I mean, being on strike and not working to me, or I mean, then I'm always on strike in a way. We're on strike. Here's the strike sign, by the way. I can hold it up. Hold on. I'm holding it up. This is it. Writers Guild of America. It's bright red. This is a simple, generic strike sign. I should have it behind my head as a convenient backdrop.
Have you been picketing?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. What?
Have you been picketing?
I can't hear you. I mean, I can hear you. I'm just not answering. I'm going to actually take this. I was going to say, I could take this little poster, this little strike sign. I'm going to frame it and hang it in my house. It will be the most expensive piece of art I own.
Why expensive?
Because this strike is costing me a lot of money.
Well, it's weird. I hear two things about you, Rob, when I travel around Hollywood. One is...
Wow. You travel around Hollywood, Mickey?
I do.
Okay.
I was in Hollywood just last night, the
really?
Actual town of Hollywood.
Oh, wow.
But I hear Rob Long, he's a Republican, but he's nice. I mean, you know, he's conservative. He's
only half of that is true.
He's not mean.
Yeah.
And the second thing is, why doesn't he get with the program, you know? I mean, the writer's strike is right, and you're like a dissenter from the union, and you're a scab, and they don't
I'm not a scab.
They don't say you're a scab, but they say you should, you know, the writers are right, they should get some money, and
right.
Why doesn't Rob, you know, come along with us?
Who says that?
Somebody last night, I forget who.
I need names, Mickey.
I'll give you the name afterwards.
I'm a dissident from the union. I mean, I dissent from it, but I've been an 18-year member. I've kicked in a lot of money to it. I think it's like a crazy relative who comes at the on the exactly the wrong time and wants to stay in your house. You put up with it. But I don't. I'm not against the idea of even going out on strike, and I'm not even against the idea of having demands. I just think these demands are sort of misguided, misthought out. They're not strategic. They're not. They're not appropriate to what it is that we do, and they don't do the thing they should be doing, which is to increase the number of opportunities for writers, so we increase the number of members of the Writers Guild, and two, to protect those writers whose careers are not stellar, right? To allow people who maybe only sell one project every 2 or 3 or 4 years to still be able to live in L.A. County, which is, you know, hard to do.
I haven't read your blog because every time I go to it, something horrible happens to my computer, like I get a virus or it crashes. So
how do you get a virus from my blog? It's a very simple blog.
And I went to it has Flash or something. It has some.
It does not.
It's fancy. It has Twitter. It has all sorts of fancy things.
It has Twitter.
You've just gone crazy. You've built in a bunch of complicated.
It's new media, man. Come on, Grandpa. You don't have Twitter. What's your problem?
Anyway. Here's my basic question. I mean, you go to the movies, you read movie reviews, everybody says the writer is all important. If the movie has a terrible script, it's not going to work. So you figure, how could the writers fail to capitalize on their importance into the movie? I mean, a movie can survive a bad director. It can't survive a bad script.
No, that's wrong.
That's wrong?
No, look, I love writers. I'm a writer. I mean, I will defend writers and write. But movies, TV, these things are, you know, you can have a huge hit TV show that stinks. The writing stinks. You can have a fantastic pick. I mean, a good director, I mean, a really good director can make a bad script a lot better.
Huh.
That's just the way it is. I mean, it's a visual medium. It's like it's all these things together. I mean, you can't have an idea without a writer first. But and I'm not diminishing the what the writers contribute. It's really important. I mean, I'm a writer. But I think we need to sort of get off our high horse.
But if there were no union, writers would still be highly paid. So how could they screw that up?
Because the point is the bulk of a working writer's pay pack is not union related. I mean, put it this way. The work that I do in television, I mean, I get a vast sum to write, to do an episode or to write to produce an episode or to write a pilot. Or, you know, they used to pay me a lot of money just to sit on my butt at a studio and think of ideas. Okay, so that had nothing to do with the guild.
Yeah. I should probably identify you for our audience before we go further.
Why would you bother? Apparently, as you travel in your circles in Hollywood, I'm the subject of much conversation.
Well, but that's
must be well known.
It's mostly how nice you are. You're a screenwriter.
I am.
You wrote for Cheers.
I did.
You now write for National Review and do commentary on NPR, and you're author of two books. One book called Conversation with My Agent. I lent to a bartender, and it was so good she never gave it back to me.
Wow.
And now you can't get it. And the second
book...
Well,
you can.
The second book is called Set Up Joke.
Are you holding these up?
I'm holding this up.
Good.
And it says here, it's the funniest and wisest thing to come out of Tinseltown since Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yeah.
And I know you're a fan of Curb Your Enthusiasm, Rob.
I you know what? I'll tell you. I thought it had a great first season, and then I thought it dipped. But I have to be... And I remember last time we talked about it, I was fulminating about how terrible it was.
Yes.
This last season was fantastic.
You're just saying that because the blurb is on the cover of your book.
No, I'm not. I'm saying the last season was quite good. I was really... I think that he... I think it was the best season yet.
Huh.
The season before, I hated. I hated it when he was, like, doing the producers. I thought that was stupid and self-conscious, and he seemed to be smirking his way through it. This last one, I thought, huge laughs. It was great.
Huh.
Well, it's changed. That's why you do more than one season.
Maybe it helps if you break up with your wife. Let's not go there.
Well... I don't know about the story behind the story, but it made for a really funny show.
So back to the strike. So if your pay package has very little to do with the union, why the strike? It's because all the people who don't have a big pay package.
Yeah, and that's fair. I just feel like if we're a union and we're setting minimums and we're setting the minimums for people, look, I mean. The more residuals matter to you, I mean, the bigger that residual package is for you, the more you got paid to begin with, right?
Right.
So we're really talking about people who, I mean, to help people who have had a smaller flow, right, career flow,
but
or a shorter one.
People who never get anything bought don't have any residuals, right? It's not like they join the union and automatically they get $30,000 a year.
No, you got to have a project in some kind of, you know, downstream, whatever they call it, downstream exploitation. Which is a fantastic phrase, by the way. I want to use it more. Downstream exploitation.
But so they're fighting over the future downstream exploitation of the Internet. Why isn't that exactly what the writers should be focusing on?
They should be focusing on it.
They missed the DVD boom, and now they're about to miss the Internet boom.
That's exactly my point. My point is they missed the DVD boom, and they're mad about it. So now, in anger, they're trying to make a deal where they're treating the web as just another ancillary market. Right, it's just one more thing. It's like goes along with DVDs and cassettes and reruns, and it's really not. My suggestion to them, which of course they don't like, is I'm a nice Republican, but I'm not with the program, as you put it. My suggestion is let's come up with an upfront number that's big that they can pay you to run it for a year, and then after a year they come up with one more upfront number to pay you. And that lasts maybe 3 years. And they pay you bigger checks, fewer checks, less often. But it kind of like, we don't have to then know how many times this thing was run in New Zealand or how many times it was sold to, Southeast Asian market. I mean, these things are irrelevant.
But if they get their number wrong, then they're screwed. Then they've got
they're screwed until 5 years from now when we can go out on strike for one number, get that number up. But see, that way...
No, but if the studios put the number too high, then nobody knows what this market's going to be. If the studios put the number too high, then in 5 years there are no more studios because they've all gone broke. They're paying writers for things that they're not generating any revenue from.
Not necessarily. No. I mean, then obviously the number won't be outlandishly high. It'll be something based on what you can reasonably expect in a year. But I don't want to know. I don't care how they show my work, whether they show it on broadcast or pay cable or free cable or reruns or off-network reruns or on streaming on the web. It doesn't makes no difference to me. I don't think as a writer it shouldn't make any difference to us. What do we care?
Yeah,
I just want to get paid for it.
Are we only talking about what happens to, TV shows? You make you show a show on TV and then it goes into syndication or it goes on the web.
Yeah.
And are you saying that whole model will dissolve, that it won't be first shown on TV, it'll first be shown?
Of course.
And are you saying the writers are geared to maintaining that model, but it's going to dissolve and then they're going to be screwed?
I'm saying it's General Motors, 1973. And General Motors is wrong, and the UAW is wrong. Right? There was no brain trust in 1973 at General Motors who said, well, we're in trouble. Everybody's going to be buying Toyotas. They just thought, okay, we'll deal with the UAW, and the UAW was asking for a lot, and they said, okay, we'll haggle and find some number. And meanwhile, the Japanese are opening up plants everywhere, and everybody's buying a Datsun or whatever it was back then.
But you could argue that since GM is still around and the UAW is still around, and it's just whittled down gradually, But that was actually a smart move for the existing members. I mean, they're all retired now. Everybody who's around 1973 has had a nice life and worked at the, not a nice life, but a normal working life, making union pay, and they've all retired now with full health benefits. So they did. The union did right by them. They did wrong by American industry.
Whose side are you on, man?
I'm just saying that.
You could make that case. I don't know. I think that the unemployment in the Rust Belt started to rise around 1974, right?
So everything went all to hell in America in 1974.
Or did it all coalesce?
No, but if you look at all the charts, 1974 was the Ford administration was when all the economic indicators
went south.
Went south, yeah.
Well, I would just say that that is not a model to march around a studio with in the rain. By the way, I heard a great riposte by some, you know, craft union. I think it was a first AD or second AD, not craft, but like a IATSE guy. As the writers were picketing outside, he opened up his office window and shouted, "I'll march with you when you stop writing exterior night rain." It's a very inside thing. Like when the writers stop writing scenes that take place at night in the rain, we'll get the crews and the Teamsters will be more behind us, which is a good point.
And that's because they don't like to work at night in the rain?
Yeah.
But isn't the rain fake rain?
No, it's still wet. It's fake. It doesn't matter whether it comes from a cloud or a gigantic, round shower head.
So they weren't objecting that it was like bad, cliched.
No, they're checking that at night, you shoot at night, and everybody gets there at 7 o'clock at night, and they work until 4 in the morning. And then, you know what happens? Then the producer, who's also a member of the Writers Guild usually, comes up to the, whoever the UPM is, or the UPM does this, comes up to the various...
What's a UPM?
UPM, Unit Production Manager.
Okay.
The guy who, basically keeps track of who's working and how long they're working on the crew. And at at 4 in the morning, he comes up to you and says, now, are you going to be a jerk about the turnaround time? Meaning, are you going to insist on 12 hours turnaround, which is what the union says? I mean, the dirty little secret here for all the writers, I mean, I hate doing this because I clearly at Hollywood parties I'm talked about as a the skunk of the garden party. But the dirty secret is that there's not a writer in town who's really ever done any real work on a set who hasn't complained about the union rules that the Teamsters and the IATSE people live by. Who hasn't said, oh, God, they have to have their dinner break now? And now we're marching around like we're sort of, wobblies together.
Well, you shoot until 4 in the morning and you're mad because they don't want to come back at 9 in 5 hours?
No, they're
hours.
Not. Right. No, they have a 12-hour turnaround. No, you have to organize these like a puzzle piece. It's perfectly fair. But I don't think there's any really – and I've never met a working writer, I mean, who's a writer-producer who's produced things too, who's has not complained about that.
Well.
Yeah.
No, I had some thought, but I've lost it. So all the shows are going to take place in the daytime now.
Yeah. Well, probably not. No.
It's going to be Route 66. The clock.
I just think that the inter-union brotherhood between the writers and the writers and the Teamsters and the writers and IATSE, I believe it will last about the good feelings will last about 24 hours after the strike is over.
What do you think is going to happen?
What was destined to happen, probably. I think the directors are going to get a great deal. They're going to go in next week, maybe, a week from now.
They're not on strike yet, right?
No, their contract is up in June, but they'll start working on a deal early.
Right.
They'll get a good deal probably in January. SAG will cave, and the writers will be punished.
SAG are the actors?
The actors.
But they're not on strike either.
No, but their contract is up in June. So they'll probably start early... negotiating early, right around the time that the DGA gets a deal.
Well, so you think the strike is going to go until June?
The writer's strike?
Yeah.
Good.
Did you think? Really? I heard an interesting theory at the same party where your name was taken in vain.
What was this party?
Oh, it was a business party for California Magazine.
California Magazine?
Is that California Magazine? California Magazine doesn't exist. Los Angeles Magazine.
Oh, that party.
That party.
I was invited to that.
Well, so you didn't show up.
I didn't go. Who were you talking to?
I forget. I think this thought came from Kim Masters.
He forgets. Oh, Kim Masters.
I can't say the thought, but never mind. Later, I'll come up with another thought later.
What was the thought? Well, you want my thought?
Well, I'll let me put another thought first.
Okay.
The union's going to win because the opposition, the studios, have hired Chris Lehane.
Well, yeah, I think that's possible. That made me feel very good.
A man who's presided over virtually every Democratic defeat, and it's pioneered the art of overspinning. You know, fighting back. You got to fight back instantly with all you got, and it usually results in disaster. You can talk to Governor Gray Davis about that.
Sure, Governor Gray Davis would know about it.
President
Gore. I would actually hire. I hope they hire Bob Schrum. Then we have like a exacta. You know, we have a perfect thing. But you know, we could have Peter Chernin and Les Moonves going around saying they hear the voices of the little guy.
I don't see how Schrum calls this the people versus the powerful. I guess I don't know. It would be hard to impose cookie cutter Schrumian populism on this
Hard or impossible?
Impossible, but
I don't think impossible.
Actually, you know, I mean, Hillary Clinton got into trouble with Lehaneism, which overspinning because you know they fought back against Obama claiming that Hillary was ambitious by saying oh your kindergarten essay. And, like, you know, because they did it instantly and they had a whole team geared to rapid response, nobody thought, hey, this would make us look like idiots.
Right, exactly.
And that's exactly what Lehane specialized in, is
looking like an idiot.
Is winning the news cycle but losing the war.
Exactly right. Well, the idea that the news cycle here or PR here is relevant in any way is kind of ludicrous. I mean, I would have loved to have seen the PowerPoint that Chris Lehane presented to the AMPTP because it must have been. I mean, the Writers Guild are the same way. They're sort of thrilled by like, oh, the poll numbers show that the American people support us. Like, what? This is a business dispute based on a small piece of the contract that is itself a small piece of the working writer, the working writer's life. So,
yeah, it's not going to be resolved on the basis of public opinion.
No, and when I sort of opted out of the hard stuff of all of it was when early on, like the second day of the strike. They sent an urgent email for us all to go to a March for Justice.
I would think you would respond to that, Rob. For Justice?
We're talking about money. There's nothing wrong with money. Money's perfectly legitimate. I mean, I'm a Republican. I love money. I put it this way. I'm a Republican. I only love money. But the idea that we're calling this a March for Justice and we have to listen to Jesse Jackson and John Edwards talk about justice is just not my thing.
Yeah, well, that could be like a studio ploy to grind you into submission by making you listen to Jesse Jackson.
Yeah, that could be.
We found out about Chris Lehane from the website of Nikki Fink.
Sure.
Who's become all the writers I know just read her blog incessantly.
Yeah, refresh, right.
You're looking for any clue as to what's happening. And what about this thought? She obviously has some sources on the other side in the studios, that they're jerking around the writers like a yo-yo by promising that, oh, a deal's imminent, and then, no, the deal crashes. And they're basically leaking stuff to Nikki Fink and practicing psychological torture by lifting your spirits and then
you're
deflating
basically
them.
Basically waterboarding us.
Something like that.
Yeah, I don't. It could be. I mean, I go to her site twice a day. I try to go in the morning and then later on after dinner. But it could be. Look, that's the problem with this dispute is that there are the economic requirements of all the members are not unionized. I mean, we are not unified as an economic group. We're not like Teamsters who are driving trucks or auto workers who work in a factory. We're all at different levels at different points, and I suspect that. That's the leverage the studios have. They can hold out until June. And why wouldn't they? In a way, it's like here's my dark scenario.
Yeah.
After like today or tomorrow, it's been 6 weeks, so they can force majeure anybody they have a contract with out. You know, my contract at Disney suspended, but I expect that they'll send me a letter tomorrow, the next day, and say, by the way, since you haven't worked for 6 weeks, we are. Now, force majeuring your contract, it's over. You're basically fired. The contract's canceled.
A strike counts as force majeure?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they can do that all over town.
Right.
And they can do it to people who are working on shows that are in production, right? I mean, I have a pilot I'm doing at ABC, but it, you know, hasn't been done yet, so they can stop me anytime they want. And then the strike goes on, and people get panicked, and finally, you know, the writers make a bad deal, which is inevitable. And they come back to me, and they say, oh, yeah, remember that pilot that you wrote for ABC? We still kind of want you to do that. But, you know, we're not going to pay you what we were going to pay you in the old contract. We're going to pay you 30% less.
So you're saying they make up for whatever they give the writers by screwing you, Rob Long.
Yeah, look.
And the, people like you.
The goal, exactly. The goal of the studio is to reduce overhead, right? They want to reduce the amount of money they are on the hook for in the case of failure. And this is a great business to fail in. I mean, they pay you a lot of money to fail here. 98% failure rate for television, 98% failure rate for features, right? I mean,
right.
This is a good business to be in if you're a writer, because you get to write and write and write and write, and they make a TV show that gets canceled, or they make a pilot that doesn't get bought, or they pay you for a script they never produce. I mean, this is a good business to be in. So what they want to do is they want to squeeze down all of the, not the guild minimums, but the episode fees and the inflated script fees they pay you, which is set by your agent and your lawyer. It has nothing to do with the guild.
So
if they can get that number down, that'd be great.
So this is Shrum again. I mean, this is redistribution. They're going to increase the minimum for the bad writers and screw people like you.
Well, see,
rich and give to the poor.
Here's where I get sort of big government Huckabee. I mean, I'm in favor. If this is a union, let's treat it like a union. Let's organize a set of minimums and payments to protect the writer who isn't successful, who doesn't have a deal, who doesn't have a show on the air, who's not working on the staff of a show, who doesn't have a feature film or two feature films in his budget, people who don't have haven't had a level of success that's really going to compensate them for whatever happens down the line. Let's make it for that little guy, right? So that you could actually be a writer who sells one script and then works for 10 years on another script.
But I don't quite understand. I mean, I grew up in Kansas. I come to Hollywood, and I decide I want to be a writer. I have no talent. And you're saying the union will guarantee me an income for life.
No, it doesn't guarantee you anything. You have to sell something to be a member of the union. They don't let you in. You got to make money. You have to have sold a project.
How much do you have to have sold?
Oh, I forget what it is, but it's pretty low. In fact, I know writers who when they were eligible for guild membership, couldn't afford to join the guild because it was like $2,500 or $3,500, whatever it is. And so they weren't paid enough to even pay the union dues.
Well, so everybody gets into the union, and then they all qualify for this minimum, and it seems...
You're not qualifying for the minimum, right? The minimum is based on for minimum feature fee, minimum pilot fee. Those are rarely... used. I mean, mostly if a network is going to pay you to write a pilot script, they're going to pay you a significant sum over the guild minimum.
Right. Okay.
That's just to keep you from being exploited.
Okay.
But that's where the fat is in all these budgets. The fat are in these episode fees. And the truth is that the studios all compete with each other for talent. So they got to pay me, you know, whatever, thousands of dollars an episode. Because if they don't pay me, I can get it from Sony, or I can get it from 20th, or get it from Warner Brothers, right? But since all Sony, Warner Brothers, and 20th, and CBS, they're all in a room together right now, they can collude on what they're going to pay, not the minimum, but the maximum. I mean, it's brilliant. They can actually take 30% probably off the top.
Well, but then once the strike is over, they'll start competing, so they'll want your services, Rob.
Yeah, but they'll have it. If they can just do a break in the bubble, that would be great.
Yeah. Well, so if all these writers are out of work, then maybe I can afford a better place around here, you know?
Yeah, well...
I should say Rob and I are neighbors, sort of.
Yeah, sort of.
He lives on
I live in a slightly more desirable part, but let's not get into it.
That's true, but my neighborhood has rustic charm.
Okay, you know what? We'll go with that. We'll say rustic charm.
So let's talk about politics.
I thought we were. Chris Lehane is...
Chris Lehane was our transition.
Okay. By the way, who pays for this Blogging Heads thing?
I think Bob has venture capital from a group headed by the guy who started C-SPAN.
Oh, C-SPAN. Well, they made a mint.
Maybe they did.
Do they have sponsors? See, that's what's going to go with television.
I don't think C-SPAN has sponsors.
Like, I would say, hey, I'm enjoying an espresso coffee. espresso for those Blogging Head TV moments when regular coffee just won't do.
It's true. I mentioned to some network correspondent that I was going on Blogging Heads, and his response was, whatever.
Yeah.
He doesn't know that we're closing in on Donnie Deutsch.
Well, I mean, good Lord. I mean,
we are. I've seen the numbers. We are closing in on Donnie Deutsch.
Really? Wow.
Slowly. But
And we're not getting paid. I'm being exploited again.
You are being exploited. Totally.
Well, as my agent said years ago when I told her I was writing a novel, She said, hey, look, if you want $800, I'll give you $800. So, I sort of feel like the way of play. I'm doing Blogging Heads TV. Look, here's $20.
No, you're going, you know, we're expanding your brand, name recognition.
I know, you're right. I can monetize myself, finally.
So
you can't see me, Mickey, but, you know, I'm growing a beard. I'm not really growing it, I'm just simply not shaving. And it's coming in all gray, which is not good.
That is scary. Maybe you should, like, nip that in the bud.
Have to fix that.
Here's the thing on the Hillary campaign. I think we're at the moment. Remember you that scene in for some reason I was thinking about the movie Titanic, where the guy that designs the ship goes to the ball and says, in an hour and a half, this entire ship will be sitting at the bottom of the ocean. That's sort of the Hillary campaign. In a month and a half, she's going to be sitting at the bottom of the ocean, and people sort of know it. Yeah, I think, well, this is the CW of the moment, but I think it's right. She's terrible on the attack. You know, she has this theory.
You're right.
She has this theory. She's going to take out Obama, and even if Edwards wins Iowa, that's okay because she can deal with Edwards later.
Yeah.
And she can't deal with Obama. But her attacks on Obama have been totally ineffectual. They've only driven her further down.
Well,
so then what does she do?
The irony is that she's in this terrible box, and it's actually kind of it's like a perfect storm of vulnerabilities and flaws. I mean, Obama is going to get a lot of attention if he just keeps saying, Bush, Clinton, bad for America. Turn the page.
Right.
I mean, he could be new. I mean, when was the last Democrat who won on the I'm experienced ticket?
Right. Well, but the war, you know, if Iraq is a mess, you sort of want somebody who knows what they're doing, no?
Do you? Or do you just want a... Look, Obama can... I don't even know what his... Obama can say anything he wants at this point. He's a fresh face. Turn the page. Americans, I think, want a new cast, right? They're going to fire the old cast. They want a brand new cast. And what could be more brand new than Obama? And I know a lot of people who, like, they just want to vote for the guy, right? I know a lot of Republicans who say, you know what? It might be good for the country.
No, he has a lot of crossover appeal. And I guess the important thing is that he's I'm just thinking this thought now, which may be bogus, that he gives the impression of constancy and stability. In other words, and that sort of the fact that he retains his equanimity in the face of Hillary's attacks shows that he's not going to go off the handle. He's not a flake.
He's cool.
He's going to appoint the same people that Hillary would appoint probably, and
he's cool.
You know, everything will be sort of stable. Continuity.
If I were Naomi Wolfing him, you know, his campaign.
Yeah.
You know, instead of earth tones, I'd say every now and then, you know, smoke that cigarette. It's a cool thing to do. It's like Steve McQueen, you know. I'll tell you something. You can't see me now, but I'm doing pretty good pantomime here. I'd say, let me tell you something, Senator Clinton. I don't buy it. You're fantastic. People love it.
The French would love it, but I don't know about Americans.
I smoke two a day, two cigarettes a day. It relaxes me.
Because it's not PC or because it's cool?
Because it's cool.
Yeah. Huh. Interesting. The,
cool, I think cool will win for him. I mean, I think he could be president.
I'm now thinking that more and more. Bizarrely, Hillary's attacks have increased his stature.
Look, the more he says, see, it's time for a new cast. See, we're going to turn the page.
Don't you think Hillary's in a bind because she's a woman, too? I mean, this is sort of the standard argument, but I think it's true that it's very hard for a woman to be nasty. Harder than for a man.
You believe that Hillary Clinton finds it difficult to be nasty?
No, it's hard to come off as forceful and appealing when you're being nasty as a woman. People think you're shrill and bitchy.
The problem with her is it seems all in service of just getting the job. I don't know what she wants to do. She really hasn't connected very well to...
Do you know what Obama wants to do?
Yeah, well, Obama doesn't have to, because what Obama wants to do is the subtext of his campaign is, we're going to elect a black guy. A black guy that we can all like, that like we're not afraid of.
And
that's the subtext of that campaign.
And part of that is that the world will like me, so I'll calm down the world?
Look, I think what Obama has going for him, I mean, I'm a Republican, so it terrifies me. But I think what he has going for him is he can say, you know, you can vote, we can all vote for this guy. He's not going to be that far left. I mean, were I Obama, I'd be moving more to the center when I get the nomination.
Well, you can easily do that.
You can easily do that. He's going to be this fresh face we haven't seen before. He's going to make me feel good about this country and about the unity we need. I think that you could have a moment where people say, you know, I want to actually elect somebody that I like. that I'm going to see. You know, Americans are what they when they elect a president, they're just casting a guy to be on their TV for 4 years.
Right.
Is he going to wear well? I mean, this guy's going to be with me for 4 years. And I think they're going to like Obama. They're going to like the way what it says about us as a country. They're going to like what it says about them as the person pulling the lever for Obama. They're going to like it. And as long as he doesn't scare people, I think he can win this.
It's weird. I always thought that Obama – I liked Obama because he had the potential to be a black Gary Hart. But it turns out he's the black Jimmy Carter. I mean, Rich Lowry wrote that in National Review. And that does seem to be right. He's not a guy who really wants to bust Democrats, you know, sort of mistaken – knee-jerk assumptions. He's a moralist, and he has a sticks his chin up, and he's sort of moralistic the way Carter is. But so is Huckabee.
But you know what? Here's the difference between Obama, I think, and Carter. Is that Obama, when he gets in, I have no doubt that his Secretary of Treasury is going to be a Bob Rubin figure.
Right.
You know, I get the establishment.
Carter's choices were all establishment.
Establishment Washington. I think that Obama's going to be more. Actually, have probably a better, you know, that better sort of Clintonian kind of business picks, which I think are going to make people feel good.
But my point is that Huckabee is also a Jimmy Carter figure. I mean, he's not that conservative. He sort of believes in a lot of big government. His whole basis is a moralistic appeal. So we're going to have Jimmy Carter versus Jimmy Carter.
Finally. And you know how many houses are going to be built for the poor? I don't think Huckabee's going to get it.
Why not?
They haven't even begun to tear him apart for spending so much money. He's a big government Republican.
Right.
I can't wait to, you know, New Hampshire is going to be, you know, WMUR-TV9 is going to be saturated with attack ads on, what do we really know about Governor Huckabee of Arkansas? He's an Arkansas Republican. What do we really know about him?
But didn't he was endorsed by Grover Norquist, or he was semi-endorsed. Grover said nice things about him.
Okay.
I don't know. It just seems to be, he reminds me of Jimmy Carter, and at this stage in the campaign in 76, everybody said, oh, Carter, he's going to be ripped apart in New Hampshire. And then he wasn't.
But I think he wasn't, but that doesn't mean that 30 years later that Mitt Romney and Giuliani, who have a lot of money, aren't going to rip him apart.
Yeah. Did you...
is what I would do, right?
Did you see Romney's speech, big speech, or did you hear it? Did you read it?
I didn't. I didn't read it or hear it. I'm going to sit down and read it soon. I'm eager to find out what he has to say about Mormonism.
Well, he doesn't go into Mormonism. That's the,
really?
That's the essential contradiction of the speech, is he says...
That's all we want to know. I want to know about the underwear.
Yeah, I know. He doesn't go into the underwear. He says he wants credit for all the things that you like. So he wants credit for believing in Jesus Christ and believing in God. But if you want to go any further... It's a test of tolerance. It's against the American way to ask me any more. It's mighty convenient that he happens to draw the line exactly where his beliefs begin to depart from the majority of voters.
The New Testament. The new Testament, I mean to say, yeah.
And
I think he'd be better off simply not addressing it. I don't know why he's addressing it at all.
It wasn't that bad. It's contradictory, but he might be able to pull it off. His speech had a very good closing anecdote.
Okay.
It had two John Adams anecdotes, which seems like two too many, but the second one was good. And
plays well in New Hampshire.
Or maybe one was John Quincy Adams. I think they were both John Adams. And it had this horrible paragraph, though, which I was so awful I had to blog about it before we went on, which is he has this condescending sort of petting zoo paragraph where he says, "Now, I admire many things about many other religions. I admire the Jews for their ancient heritage, and the Lutherans for their independence, and the Muslims for praying so often." You know, and it's like, and what do you say about the dumb kid in the class? You know, he's punctual.
He's so clean. Right, and the Zoroastrians for their wonderful, wedding feast.
Right, and their food.
Yeah,
the Chinese for their food.
And the Chinese for their reverence for their elders.
Yeah, it was absurd. It was like,
good for him.
It was like he was trying to boost the self esteem of all the kids on his football team. You know?
That's right. We're all look. I don't know why he did it. I don't know. I mean, I'm not looking at the numbers. Maybe he needed to, but it seemed to me that the best thing for him to do is say, "Oh, come on, it's just another Christian sect. Relax." You know,
And
I say this as someone who embraces all faiths and creeds, and I love all people, irrespective of their religion. It's weird, that one. And so the less we talk about it, probably the better. I mean, because when a religion has a specific kind of underwear, that's the thing you want to kind of bleep over.
I sort of like the idea of the underwear. That's one of the more appealing aspects of the Mormonism, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's like, it's supposed to be uncomfortable, right?
I don't know.
I think that's the idea.
I'm not wearing any.
Rob.
I had a Mormon, people are watching.
You can't.
I mean, I'm wearing underwear. I'm just not wearing Mormon underwear.
Oh, okay. I'm good.
I did have a Mormon assistant once. And about the seventh or eighth day in, we said, hey, are you wearing that Mormon underwear? And his voice is, I knew you guys were going to ask me about the underwear at some point. It's supposed to remind you of your covenants, he said.
And was he wearing it?
I never got into it, but I love the phrase, it's supposed to remind you of your covenants, which really means it's supposed to be really complicated to take off. So you really have to want it off, you know?
Is that the idea? Okay.
Yeah, it doesn't just fall off. You have to make a choice. There's a lot of buttons and et cetera. So you have a lot of opportunities to, like, have second thoughts and say, you know what, maybe we shouldn't do this.
That also seems very functional. So I'm pro.
You're pro Mormon underwear.
I'm pro Mormon underwear.
Good for you. Well, you're maintaining your sterling reputation as an iconoclast.
I'm trying to think if I have anything more to say about this. It's good for Romney that people are talking about him, though, and he's an appealing figure. So it seems to me.
I don't know. Maybe so. I don't know. I'm not sure of that. I'm not convinced of that. I'm not convinced that what he needs to do is to. I think what he needs to do, what both these guys need, both Giuliani and Romney need to do, is to neutralize Huckabee. Or actually, I don't think Giuliani needs to do that. I think that Romney needs to do that. So rather than talking about his religion, I would be talking about why that guy is dangerous. I would be driving Huckabee's negative side.
But this is Iowa. If you do that in Iowa, you lose.
Really?
Because they're nice people there, Rob.
They are?
You know that. You've driven across the country.
Well, they're nice people everywhere.
Yeah. That's the cliche, and I think it's sort of true.
No, but you know, there's nice and there's nice and there's true. You could just say he spends a lot of money. Flinty, hard, you know, farmer stock. We don't cotton to big government.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
He's not corrupt. He's just misguided.
Negative campaigning has a terrible reputation, but it's hugely effective.
What is a terrible reputation?
Negative campaigning.
Oh yeah, no, I agree with that. That's why, I mean, it's the only thing I could say for Ed Thompson. He's obviously incapable of positive campaigning. But he's great on the attack.
He's good on the attack.
I think John Dickerson at Slate finally wrote that piece.
The question for Huckabee is going to be, do you really think you're going to win? And when it's clear you're probably not, who are you pissing off? Because Huckabee's a fantastic veep choice, right?
I guess that's right.
And if you're Giuliani or you're Romney, you know, it'd be nice to have a former evangelical minister on your ticket, right?
Right. Although, a Romney Huckabee ticket, that's pretty religious, pretty heavy on the religiosity.
Yeah, just think of the underwear.
Well, I think we're through with the campaign.
Thank God. No, I mean, they're still going on. We're done talking about it.
Yes. And I wanted to raise the issue that always comes up when one talks with a conservative Hollywood screenwriter or actor or producer.
Both of those times?
No, there are three or four of them.
Yeah, in the old days, I had a joke. I used to say that the good news is that one out of every three Hollywood Republicans goes on to become president of the United States. You can't say that now. A lot of us.
Well, but maybe you won't elect that many presidents. You can all fit into somebody's living room, though, can't you?
No. No, that person would have to hire a tent.
I thought you've been in that living room. It's Gary Sinise's living room, and you were all there.
I've never been in Gary Sinise's living room.
But there was some party that Gary Sinise gave for all the right-wingers in town.
And they weren't all. Some of us were out of town at the time.
They didn't have to call in the police for crowd control. It all fit in somebody's house.
It all probably fits in somebody's large backyard.
Yeah, if you put all the liberals in town in the sports arena, it would collapse. Hmm. I mean,
good idea.
There's just no comparison. But anyway, I think there is discrimination against right-wingers in Hollywood. It's based on two experiences. Okay. One is I ran into a conservative director, and I said – I called him a right-winger, and he sort of said, shh, you know, and he needs to raise financing for his movies. Mm-hmm. He didn't want it known that he was a right-winger because that would kill his chances of getting liberal money.
Really?
And he's a very good director, so I thought that was credible. This was about 10 years ago, so maybe it's changed. And the second thing is I was having this argument with a friend of mine. He said, oh, yeah – I know somebody, a writer who was about to be hired for a TV show to sit in the room and do whatever you writers guys do, and then they found out he was a Republican and they canceled it.
Wow.
Those are my two pieces of evidence. You think that's not true?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I only know my experience, which has been, I've been a Republican for ever. I mean, it's like the Red Sox is the team, you know. Half the time I hate them, right? So half the time I don't. So, I came. I'll put it this way. I moved here in 1988. I graduated from college in 87. So I started here in 88. I had my first job in 1990.
Right.
At age of 24. So should we pause while you do the math? I'm 42. I found actually Hollywood to be more open. I mean, I was working on a show called Cheers, right?
Right.
Which is filled with incredibly active left-wing Democrats. From
right.
the top of the show, from the management of the show, from my first boss, all the way to the cast. And they never once, I don't think, held it against me. And I worked there all the way. I was one of the executive producers at the end of it.
Did they hit up the other people for campaign contributions?
Yeah.
Isn't that a crime?
I didn't even know I wasn't supposed to say okay. I said, forget it. I'm not going to give Barbara Boxer any money. I'm a Hershenson man. or whatever it was. I think it was Hershenson. Was it Hershenson Boxer? No, that was probably too late.
Well, that's sort of funny in itself. But
yeah, that's right. Right. But I never felt, I mean, I actually feel, maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like there's more freedom of thought and expression in Hollywood than there was when I was in college. I think a major U.S. university is a more closed-minded and, I think, you know, speech-coded place than Hollywood.
Did you feel really stifled in college? I find that hard to believe.
Oh, well, you know. I mean, I wasn't that right-wing in college, you know. I cast my first vote in 1984. I was whatever I was then. I voted for Jesse Jackson in the Connecticut State primary.
So why did you become right-wing?
Because I was told all through high school and college that Ronald Reagan was a crazy man who was going to blow up the universe with his crazy nuclear bombs, and that the Soviets were our friends, and really it was just a matter of misunderstanding. And when that didn't happen, right, all these dire predictions from the left didn't happen, you start saying, wait a minute, if that's not true, what else isn't true? And then you see things like, well, okay, so someone writes a good book on welfare reform, that makes sense. And then you talk to some people about school choice, and that seems to make sense. So pretty soon you just kind of gravitate, for me, just gravitated to the right. I'm not that far right. I mean, I always say this about Hillary Clinton. You know, I am to the left of Hillary Clinton on some social issues. I'm in favor of gay marriage. I'm against the death penalty. Pick another one, you know. And those are pretty big.
Where are you on choice and abortion?
I'm pro-choice.
Huh.
But I'm also pro-school choice, which I think is a slightly more important issue.
It is, but
and I will vote for a Democrat who's really robustly in favor of school choice.
I guess you aren't much of a conservative then. The people that the National Review should really watch.
They should fire me. No, they know this. Like, I'm a wet Republican. I'm exactly the worst kind of Republican. I'm a New England Republican. I'm the first one they kick out of the party when it, you know.
What do you feel? How do you feel about national health insurance?
Oh, it terrifies me.
Why does it terrify you?
Seems like a very expensive thing. It seems like it's going to be bringing of us all the benefits of the national health insurance in Britain, and none of the fun. And also, I think it's just going to lead to more and more divisions where middle class people are forced to, you know, it's going to create a school system, the public school system, where only the very rich get to go to private schools.
No,
only the very rich will get good health care. The rest of us have to just, you know, stand in line.
Well, the goal is that everybody stands in line, but they get good health care, and then the rich get super good health care. But
yeah, well, the goal is that everybody gets a great free education, and the rich can go to, you know.
I mean, I judge by Medicare, which is you know, the most left wing health care position is Medicare for all.
For everyone.
So let's look at what Medicare does now for old people. My father had cancer. He went to what was by his research and by everybody said one of the best oncology centers in the city, and he was a judge, and he was sitting next to plumbers and, you know, custodians and poor people, and they were all getting the same care, and it was all good care. So it seems to me that's a success. It's not that My father got a lousy care because he was in the system with everybody else. He got very good care because he was in the system.
Could you have gotten that? Isn't it possible that you get that kind of good care because it's, you know, let's be honest, it's fresh and it's dated. A lot of people who would qualify don't live that long. And the people who do qualify are already old. I mean, you know, no offense, but you've taken a group of people who go to the doctor a lot, probably, but there's only so much we can do. And you said, okay, at the very end of your life, you're sort of covered. I mean, the hard part is not covering people at the end of their life. It's covering them from the day they're born.
I think the expensive part is the end of the life.
The expensive part has become the end of the life.
But it's inherently the end of the life because you're fighting a losing battle. And you're resorting to more and more technological tricks to win that losing battle.
Right, but you know that is going to be adjusted downward, isn't it? I mean, you'll probably get a break on it if you sign one of those advanced healthcare directives.
What do you mean, get a break on it?
You'll probably get a break on your insurance. I mean, they'll come up with some way to say, okay, look.
That is what I'm worried about, and I'm especially worried that Hillary is going to do that. Yes,
because
that's her instinct.
It's the only way to do it, isn't it?
Well, no, it depends. It's only the way to do it if you have cost cutting as one of your overriding goals.
But isn't that the overriding goal? Right? Isn't that the goal?
Well, people praise Hillary's plan because she sort of downplayed cost cutting.
Well,
and it seems to me
I would too.
Anytime the reason I like government health insurance is because I think the politics will militate against cost cutting. When you try to make people sign advanced directives, there's going to be such a stink that the government will be less effective at making people do that than
I think
the private sector.
I think you're looking at the healthcare. The healthcare bureaucracy that's created by National Health Insurance will resemble LA Unified School District, which is simply not responsive to anybody's demands or questions or accounting or anybody's consumer pressure at all.
But that's
I think it's like a fantasy that it will be.
But that's not true with Medicare. So why should it be true with National Health Insurance? Nobody's more sensitive to, you know. Well, anyway.
I don't know.
I mean, I think people just won't stand for it. If they try to kick mothers out of the hospital after a day, Hillary Clinton sponsors a bill saying, no, we guarantee them 2 days. And then they're guaranteed 2 days. So the results will be not cost-cutting, but it'll be the over-provision of services, which is fine with me. Anyway.
Not me, though, because I'm a Republican.
Okay, well, you really are a Republican, then.
You know, are there new workhouses? That's my point.
Yeah. Well, maybe they shouldn't fire you at National Review.
Well, that's what they keep saying. It's like I have the cold, hard heart of a Republican. But on a few issues, I don't know.
I'm surprised that you're anti-death penalty.
I am. I think...
You see, you're for killing babies and saving murderers.
Yeah,
I mean you're for your
no, I'm not for it. I just the death penalty. I feel like two reasons. One, I don't think it's a deterrent, because the people who are on death row weren't thinking. And the second thing is, I just don't like giving the government or society that kind of power. That will only lead to trouble. I think it's a small price to pay to keep someone in prison for the rest of their lives.
That's Reitweger famously said it's like like having the U.S. Post Office have the job of deciding to kill people.
That's how Republicans always, you know, that's our he used the U.S. Post Office, I use LA Unified.
But for the death penalty too?
Yeah, all metaphors, all government metaphors.
Okay. Well, I think I don't know if LA Unified has a national appeal. I say go national, Rob.
All politics is local, man. You're probably right, but then I'm not. I'm a local.
And you defend the French.
I love the French. I especially now. My God, no, I love the French. I think the French have a place in the international conversation. I don't like. I love France. I think it's great.
This is like Romney's petting zoo. I love the French for their food. Their food is good.
No. Their food. That's an important thing. I also think, unfortunately, I think with France right now, they got to figure out a way to, and I think Sarkozy might do it, to implement certain reforms to keep what they've got and to be a little bit more competitive. The problem is that's sort of a slippery slope. I mean, if you go to Paris always looks gorgeous, but that's because it sucks in all these resources from the rest of the country. Trouble can be brewed that way. It's not a stable society, France.
It isn't?
No. I mean, my God. How many revolutions and new governments and collapses of old governments have they had in 200 years? Lots.
Hmm.
When we were we were trying to decide between Gilded Age presidents. They still had an emperor.
Well, so how would it be unstable this time? You're not talking about the Muslims in the Bonne News. You're talking about something else.
Yeah, I'm talking about like what happens when people from the outside of Paris suddenly realize what a strange elite there is in Paris. That the elite, if you go to two or three schools, you have a sort of a guaranteed job. What happens when they sort of want access to sort of capital and they start like being capitalists in Toulouse and Lyon and all the other places? They're going to start feeling like maybe they should pay less in taxes that go directly to Paris to keep the streets beautiful.
Hmm.
I mean, you go to Paris right now. Paris is like a dream. I mean, if the dollar wasn't so weak, it'd be a fantastic retirement place for Americans because everything's subsidized.
Mm-hmm.
And the town is gorgeous. It's just that it sucks resources from the rest of the country.
You would just think that if they wanted to revolt against the domination of people who've gone to the right schools, they would have done it a while ago.
Well, you know, give them time.
Yeah.
It's like the Chinese.
Well, plus now it's moved up to a higher level. The people that go to the right schools are in Brussels dictating to all of Europe.
Right.
So a revolution in France won't really do them any good.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I think that we Americans always think of Europe as the stable place where they have traditions. The traditions usually in Europe are revolution and sort of mass murder. Not really, you know. We're the old guys. We're the old guard here.
Huh.
We seem positively hidebound. You know, we haven't changed our system of government in, how many hundreds of years?
This is a dark note you're ending us on.
We have to end on a dark note? That's crazy.
No.
Let's find something. There's something good is happening. Let's talk about something good.
I can't think of anything. They're building a Whole Foods down the street.
Do you think that's good?
No, it's going to destroy the neighborhood.
You think?
Yes.
Well, it will destroy the neighborhood, or it will confirm the neighborhood has been destroyed already?
Well, both. I should say we live in Venice, California, which is unlike virtually every other community I've lived in, sort of pleasantly mixes very rich and very poor people.
Yes.
Not totally, obviously, but...
Not totally pleasantly.
Not totally pleasantly, but pretty pleasantly. But we have, you know, it's... And it's not just racial. They're sort of poor people of all ilks here.
And crazy people.
But it's become such a desirable place to live that
pretty
much the streets are now filled with BMWs and Audis.
It's a place of derelicts and poseurs, which is not a bad thing. I don't know.
I think I'm both.
Well, you're definitely one.
Anyway, those places are rare and fragile, and it's about to be destroyed, I think.
Well,
but
look,
slowly.
It's just a matter of time. I mean, the Venice is inside L.A. It's the last part of L.A. that hasn't been, you know, overcome by enormous sums of money in real estate investment. So what are you going to do? I mean, either you want to live here or you don't. If you want to have a house, you have to move, you know, how many, 2 hours away. I mean, that's why, I mean, just to get back to the politics of movie making and TV making, just to wrap it all up, because I know on Blogging Heads TV it's important to have a summing up. You notice that on going to any movie set or TV set, the actors and the directors, they tend to be very left-wing Democrats, and the crew tend to be a lot more conservative. And I was talking to a studio head about that. We were sort of laughing. He goes, "Yeah, well, you know why those crew guys are so right-wing? Because they have to, you know, they listen to all that talk radio for hours and hours and hours every day."
I mean, because they live in Fillmore.
Because they live in Apple Valley, they're driving for 3 hours, and so they're listening to, you know, Rush and Hannity and all those guys. And so, like, well, because they can't afford to live in L.A. because you guys just spent $17 million on a house in Brentwood.
Oh, but that may be why Rush and Hannity are so popular, because their natural audience is people who are so pissed off at having to drive all the way from the suburbs.
Or they're just in the car anyway, driving in the suburbs. I mean, they're not listening to, NPR.
I am.
I know you are.
And I listen to you on NPR, Rob.
Thank you.
But so what we need is a huge crippling strike that, like, makes all these rich people in West L.A. less rich.
And we're having it.
Hey. All right. It's Bob Shrum's fantasy fulfilled.
It's happening, and it's happening before. It's unfolding slowly before our eyes. And we're powerless to stop it. It's the best kind of change.
I'm powerless to stop it, but you aren't.
No, not what can I do?
You could lead a march across the picket line.
I don't lead marches across anything. And I won't cross the picket line. I won't scab. I won't cross the picket line. This is the team I'm on, for better or for worse. I'm just going to sit in the corner and think my dark thoughts, but that's about it.
I'm sure the leadership will be heartened by this display of solidarity.
No, I think they already. I think I'm already in their crosshairs. The next time I appear here, it'll be having been fined and I'm sure tarred and feathered by the brain trust over at the WGA.
That'll be great.
Yeah.
Okay. Well.
So now this is my first Blogging Heads TV. How did I do? Did I do okay?
I think you did fine. I didn't see what you did, so.
I wasn't doing anything.
Maybe there was like a lot of great physical comedy going on.
No, just my normal expressive self.
Oh, that'll do.
But is this was it deep enough? Was it not deep enough?
I think we'll let others decide that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want to upset the venture capitalists behind the big C-SPAN success.
No, I'm like Mitt Romney, Rob. You know, I admire your punctuality.
and the tightness of the underwear.
Exactly. You showed up on time and you're clean, and that's all we really ask.
Okay, I can do that. Except for the on time and clean part, I'm signed up.
Okay, well, this was fun. Let's do it again.
Yeah, but just before I go, I just want to remind you: don't send the check to my office. Send it to my PO box here because I don't go to the office.
Okay, no, but it'll come.
Right?
Eventually.
This isn't free, is it?
I'll let you talk about that with Bob.
Yeah, what kind of business model is that? I'm not striking to be free.
The answer is it's the Arianna Huffington business model.
Oh, that's a good one.
And I told her your line, actually.
Oh, really?
Which is that when you're driving down Sunset and you figure if you turn
north,
if you turn south, you don't have to be paid. But if you turn north to go to her house...
Yeah, when I went to her house for a party, just to bring it back, I realized as I crossed Sunset to go north of Sunset, I thought, hey, I'm not writing for that Huffington Post unless they pay me. South of Sunset, you know, north of Sunset, you got to give me at least $50.
Because she lives in such a rich area, you expect to be paid.
Right.
But her response was, but south of Sunset is richer. And she's actually right.
Not on her end.
On her street it is.
No way. No way.
Well, I think this is an issue...
No way. I think as you move farther down Sunset, this is, of course, very interesting to people who don't live here. Although, what they should know is that mostly what people who do live here do is try to figure out how the various fine ways to cut the neighborhood. I live here, but not there, and a little bit like that, and it's kind of the new part of something. It's important.
Rick Caruso lives south of Sunset, man. Rich people live south of Sunset.
But he lives around Bristol, right? In Brentwood Park.
Yeah.
Okay, well, Brentwood Park is not south of Sunset where she lives. That's not Brentwood Park.
It's like two blocks away. You really are cutting it fine.
Two blocks is two blocks.
Okay.
Two blocks one way, you're in South Korea. Two blocks one way, you're in North Korea.
Yeah.
All I'm saying.
Anyway, I hate to break it to you, but you're not getting paid.
I knew. I something told me I wasn't getting paid.
But maybe I'll talk Bob into buying you dinner or something.
No, don't worry about it.
Okay.
I'm just another writer being exploited.
Well, there you go.
Well, this is fun, Mickey.
Okay, it's great.
I'll see you in the neighborhood.
See you around. Yeah, at Abbot Kinney.
Right.
Cool.
Yeah.